Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Courier for Tuesday, November 28th. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the blind and the disabled. Well, let's take a look and see here what's going on in the paper. Officially, the Christmas season has kicked off, and the paper here has some stuff regarding that. Let's take a look at the first article here. Santa rings in season on rocking horse float. Celebration raises holiday hoopla in downtown Cedar Falls. Lots of cheering and shivering were evident in the final minutes of the holiday hoopla fireworks show near the Cedar River area at the corner of First and Main Streets on Friday night. Colorful loud bursts of explosions in the sky marked the conclusion of another evening of excitement and celebration in downtown Cedar Falls. But people were still talking, even after already having spent an hour or two in the 20-degree cold, about what gets most of the attention. The topic of conversation is how Santa Claus arrived in unique fashion in year 15, as he does differently every year. "It was rocking," said Bailey Ellis of Des Moines, after seeing old Saint Nick arrive on a bright, life-size rocking horse named Stan. Santa first came on his ride up State Street to the tune of "Santa Claus is Coming to Town," and then proceeded up 2nd Street onto Main Street before crossing the bridge to Gateway Park. Ellis was following the holiday caravan along Main Street, which included a holly trolley of fun characters in Santa's cabin with wonderful plastered in lights across the top. This year's holiday hoopla theme was a whole lot of wonderful, but Ellis's mind was in a different place in terms of what the evening meant to her. "I'm thankful for all the small things," said Ellis. Her first holiday hoopla was about the lighting of the sculpture tree representing the nativity of Jesus, as well as her memorable stay at the Black Hawk Hotel, the music throughout the night, and the eggnog latte from Cup of Joe. And there is a big picture here in the paper with the fireworks going off, and it says people watch the fireworks show during the annual Waterloo Lights the Night Block Party in downtown Waterloo on Saturday. Hundreds gather for Waterloo Lights the Night event downtown. Minutes before a kickoff to holiday celebration began, snow fell from the sky. The season's first snowfall set the mood for Waterloo Lights the Night on Saturday, as hundreds of people gathered downtown at the center, at the corner of 4th Street and Sycamore. It was the third year of the event put on by Experience Waterloo. "We're excited to have little snow," said Tavis Hall, executive director of Experience Waterloo. "It makes it a true Christmas event." Oh, yes, it does. Let's go now to page 2 here and see what we've got. And I've got an article here for the Waterloo area. Inmate from Waterloo dies at Iowa State Penitentiary. A Waterloo man has died in prison where he was serving time for sexually abusing a child in 2016. Marvin Lee Higbo died at 4:50 a.m. on November 19th in the hospital room at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. According to the Iowa Department of Corrections, he was 74 years of age. Higbo was serving a 25-year sentence for second-degree sexual abuse. Authorities said that he had sexual contact with a 4-year-old girl while babysitting the child in March of 2016. He was found guilty at trial and began serving his sentence in July of 2017. Suit on mailer's sexual predator comment can move forward in Waterloo. Judges ruled that a Waterloo man's lawsuit over a 2021 mayoral campaign mailer that called him a sexual predator can go forward. Jamad Salis, age 43, said that he suffered mentally and physically after Cedar Valley Valley's Backs the Blue mailer and Facebook post highlighted his arrest as part of a criticism against incumbent Mayor Quentin Hart. Salas, a church youth leader and community organizer, had been appointed to a city police rebranding committee in 2020. He was then arrested on charges of sexual abuse in October of 2021. The CVBB material questioned the decision to name Salas to the committee and called him a sexual predator. Salas took CVBB and mayoral challenger Marcus Klein to court, noting that they are at the time of the political and that he hadn't been convicted and was awaiting trial. Attorney for Klein and the pro-police organization asked the court to dismiss the lawsuit on free speech grounds. But District Court Judge John Sullivan overruled the request. It is axiomatic in our jurisprudence that a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and an arrest is not an admission of guilt. Based entirely upon the petition, a conceivable set of facts exists that support plaintiff's request for support, support for relief, Sullivan wrote in his ruling, which was issued in September. Waterloo man charged with assault. Bond has been set at $100,000 for Waterloo man arrested for allegedly sexually assaulting an 11-year-old girl. Waterloo police arrested Marvin Ramos Bautista, age 33, on November 18th for second-degree sexual abuse, and restraining order was issued in the case. Authorities allege that Ramos sexually assaulted the girl on the 18th of November. All right, let's see what else we have here. We're turning the page, and we're now getting into the Cedar Valley section of the paper. No injuries in Shell Rock ethanol plant explosion. No one was hurt after an explosion at a bioethanol plant sent a fireball into the sky this weekend. Multiple emergency agencies from Butler and Bremer counties responded to POET, that's P-O-E-T, bioprocessing in Shell Rock on Saturday after the boom. Chris Showalter, the coordinator for Butler County Emergency Management, said the call came in around 4 p.m., and by the time fire crews arrived, the fire took care of itself. He said that the firefighters didn't see open flames in the structure, but went inside to hose down any potential hotspots. Crews were on scene for less than 2 hours. Showalter said that police were working at the plant when the blast happened, but he didn't know how close the employees were to the facility when the explosion occurred. The cause hasn't been determined, but the initial thought is that somehow combustible dust exploded. Showalter said that POET will begin an investigation as early as Monday and that the plant is still operational. All right, let's go to our next page here. Blackhawk Hotel to celebrate 170 years. Can you believe that? There's a picture here of it. The Blackhawk Hotel on Main Street in downtown Cedar Falls is celebrating 170 years of operation. Amazing. Party set for Thursday at downtown Cedar Falls Hotel. In 1853, the U.S. signed a treaty with Mexico, purchasing territory that would eventually become southern Arizona and New Mexico, while in Great Britain, Queen Victoria sat on the throne. That same year, Black Hawk County commissioners decided to locate the county seat in Cedar Falls, which boasted 450 residents. The Black Hawk steamboat churned on the Cedar River between Cedar Rapids and Waterloo, and the Winslow House Hotel was built open for business in downtown Cedar Falls. Now operating as the Black Hawk Hotel, the historic property has welcomed weary travelers for 170 years. Eagle View Hospitality is hosting a 170th birthday party celebration of the Black Hawk Hotel from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the hotel at 115 Main Street. The open house style event will include tours of the hotel, live music by Randy Clemens, drink specials from Bar Winslow, and birthday cake for the hotel's neighboring cafe, which is the La Petite. And they're showing a picture here. Boy, I'll tell you this, it's beautiful on the inside here. And you can see that I think it's been restored, I mean, because it's just beautiful. All of the flooring and the furniture, just everything. It's quite a thing to view. Okay, let's go on here. Let's move on to our next page here. And bear with me as I do that. Okay. Oh, we got an advertisement there. Okay. Now, we are in the Courier section of the paper with the opinion page, which is called Another View. And before I do that, let me see. I'm looking here. I like to read the political cartoon. There's a picture of a robot, and it says Open Artificial Intelligence. And this robot has three people in its grasp. It's really large. And the artificial intelligence mechanism says, isn't that cute? The researchers have concerns. Well, I guess that really speaks for itself. Okay, let's take a look and see what we got here. The first one is written by, let me see, look at her name, Laura Williams. And Laura writes for the columnist covering climate change. Let's take a look and see what she has to say. How to stop wind turbines from killing bats and birds. Wind power may be having a difficult year, but it's still many times cheaper than oil or gas and remains a core piece of the energy transition puzzle. A single rotation of a 260-meter-tall offshore turbine, General Electric's Halade X13MW, to be precise, can produce enough energy to power a household for more than 2 days, emitting no carbon or other pollutants. Not everyone is a fan. NIMBYism, that's NIMBYism, which stands for Not in My Backyard, is one of the biggest barriers to green energy installations at local residents protesting view-ruining turbines. But one concern regularly crops up that I have some sympathy for: how wind farms affect wildlife. After all, we're facing a biodiversity crisis here, too, where wind turbines are truly impacting animals. Effective and often cheap mitigation measures are available. Take bats, for instance. Around the world, our flying mammals are being taken out by wind turbines, either struck directly by a blade or suffering from the barotrauma, damage to tissues from air pressure changes around turbines. One estimate puts annual bat fatalities somewhere between 600,000 to 900,000 in North America alone. Research points to a simple solution. Rodrigo Medellin, an ecologist known as the Batman of Mexico, explained that as a default, turbines typically start spinning at a wind speed of about 3 meters per second, which is a gentle breeze. But many studies have found that increasing the speed at which turbines become operational to 6 meters per second reduces fatalities significantly. That's likely because insects, which certain species love to feast on, can't fly at those higher wind speeds. So bats don't either. And the cost in lost energy is negligible. Excuse me. If all turbines operated in that way, the annual energy losses would be just about 1%. That feels worth it to save some vital pollinators and pest controllers. Well, it's now a legal requirement in the European Union to curb wind farms during times of peak bat activity. In the migration season, when wind speeds are low and temperatures are mild, new technology promises smart curtailment, taking local bat activity, temperatures, and wind speeds into consideration, continuing to reduce bat fatalities while minimizing potential energy loss. In Africa and southern Europe, vultures have been struggling with wind turbines. Though these raptors have excellent eyesight to spot carrion on the ground, they have a tendency to miss the large white rotating towers that we've erected in their habitat. That's due to sizable blind spot, which stops them seeing directly in front of them as they fly. It possibly evolved to help them avoid being blinded by the sun, an effective method until humans came along and added obstacles. Plenty can be done to help avoid collisions, such as clearing up carrion, the dead animals that attract raptors, but the best thing to do is just stop the turbines. A study of 13 wind farms in Spain showed that selective stopping techniques, halting turbines when vultures fly too closely, halved mortality rates with a reduction of just 0.07% in total energy production per year. This method is in operation at Kipeto wind farms in Kenya's Rift Valley, which is located close to a large colony of endangered Rapel's vultures. In 2022, the bird-related shutdowns caused a loss of just 0.014% of the year's budgeted energy production. For other bird species, a simple paint job might suffice. A 2020 Norwegian study at a wind farm that was killing white-tailed eagles found painting one black. Black reduced the mortality rate by 70%. Projects in other regions are testing the striped blades. The threat posed to wildlife has been weaponized by clean energy skeptics. Former President Donald Trump, for instance, mourned the death of all the birds killed by wind power. But the number of avian deaths from colliding with turbines pales in comparison to the 2.4 billion murdered every year by domestic cats. Clean energy also kills far fewer animals than fossil fuel power plants do. A 2012 study estimated that wind and nuclear energy kills between 0.3 and 0.4 birds per gigawatt hour of electricity produced, compared to 5.2 birds killed per GWH of electricity from fossil fuel projects. If you're worried about the animals at a wind farm going up near you, don't oppose the project. Demand that the developer implements known techniques to minimize fatalities. We can have both wildlife and wind energy. And again, that was written by Laura Williams, who is a Bloomberg columnist covering climate change. All right, let's see what else we've got here on another view. This time it's the New York Times. Lost learning is even worse than expected. Startling evidence suggests that school closures were most damaging disruption in history. In the thick of the COVID-19 pandemic, Congress sent $190 billion in aid to schools, stipulating that 20% of the funds be used for reversing learning setbacks. At the time, educators knew that the impact on children would be significant, but the extent was not yet known. The evidence is now in, and it is startling. The school closure that took 50 million children out of classrooms at the start of the pandemic may prove to be the most damaging disruption in the history of American education. It also set student progress in math and reading back by two decades and widened the achievement gap that separates poor and wealthy children. These learning losses will remain unaddressed when the federal money runs out in 2024. Economists are predicting that this generation with such a significant educational gap will experience diminished lifetime earnings and become a significant drag on the economy. But education administrators and elected officials who should be mobilizing the country against this threat are not. It will take a multidisciplinary approach, and all the solutions that will be needed long-term can't be known. The work of getting kids back on solid ground is just beginning, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be immediate action. As a first step, elected officials at every level will need to devote substantial resources to replace the federal aid that is set to expire and must begin making up lost ground. This is a bipartisan issue, and parents, teachers, and leaders in education have a role to play as well in making sure that addressing learning loss receives urgent attention. The challenges have been compounded by an epidemic of absenteeism. Students who grew accustomed to missing school during the pandemic continue to do so after the resumption of in-person classes. Millions of young people have joined the ranks of the chronically absent, those who missed 10% or more of the school year, and for whom absenteeism will translate into gaps in learning. In the early grades, these missing children are at greater risk of never mastering the comprehension skills that make education possible. The more absences these students accumulate, the more they miss out on the process of socialization through which young people learn to live and work with others. The more they lag academically, the more likely they are to drop out. While tutoring is a step in the right direction, other measures to increase the time that students spend in school, such as after-school programs and summer school, will be required to help the students who have fallen further behind. In some communities, children have fallen behind by more than a year and a half in math. The learning loss crisis is more consequential than many elected officials have yet acknowledged. A collective sense of urgency by all Americans will be required to avert its most devastating effects on the nation's children. Reversal sought in Tyson COVID death suit dismissals in Waterloo. Attorneys for the estates of Tyson workers who died of COVID-19-related complications during the 2020 pandemic are asking the court to reconsider a ruling that dismissed their lawsuits. In October of 2023, Judge John Sullivan ruled that suits brought by representatives of Kabia Axel Mukundi and Felice Joseph lacked jurisdiction in civil court because workplace injuries are covered under workmen's compensation system, not the courts. The ruling mirrored a January of 2023 decision in suits brought by the representatives of Isdro Fernandez, Salika Bujic, Robinho Lino Garcia, and Jose Ayala Jr. that failed to find claims of wanton neglect needed to give the court jurisdiction. While the court recognizes the tragic circumstances that arose from the situation, the law requires that plaintiffs' claims proceed under the Iowa Division of Workers' Compensation pursuant to the IWCA. This court lacks the subject matter of jurisdiction to consider the plaintiff's claims, Sullivan wrote in his ruling. The court does not find that the plaintiffs have pled sufficient facts to each individual defendant that rise to the level of gross negligence amounting to wanton neglect that would remove these matters from the jurisdiction of the Iowa Division of Workmen's Compensation, the opinion reads. Workers' compensation claims, which have a lesser opportunity for damages, have been filed according to court records. Deadline for teen trust grant application nears. In Cedar Falls, the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa's Teen Trust grant application deadline for 2024 grant cycle is December 13th. Details about funding priorities, including grant request limits, as well as a link to the online grant application, may be found on CFNEIA, all uppercase, website, and I will spell this out for you, CFNEIA, and that is not, and that's all lowercase. .org/teen trust grants .grant. That's all one word. Grant applications assistance will be available up to the application deadline. Eligible grant applicants must be classified as a 501 three organization or government entities serving Blackhawk County. Organizations that are applying for the first time or the first time in several years should contact Sloan Alberheski, Teen Trust Program Director. And you can reach him at 319-243-1365 prior to submitting an application. The grant recipients will be announced in April of 2024. All right, let's see. What else do we have here? We've got some Metro briefs here. PGA Professional Wins Award. Nate Lobbs was recognized as the 2023 Iowa Professional Golfers Association of America's Youth Player Development honoree. The honor is based on the professional's entire record, with emphasis placed on performance and achievements over the past 2 years, including promoting junior golf. Lubbs' contributions to youth got programs and growing golf for juniors have been achieved through participating in PGA Junior League hosting a drive, chip, and putt local qualifier in supporting the Waterloo Junior Golf Association Tour. Gates Park hosted the Boys Junior PGA Championship the past few years, along with a yearly Iowa section Juror Tour event at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course. LCI receives grants to support services. In Waterloo, Lutheran Services in Iowa has received $10,000 from the Pauline Barrett Charitable Foundation to support therapy and behavioral health intervention services in Blackhawk County. The funding will support the delivery of mental health services to more than 110 Blackhawk County youths and individuals in need of mental health services. LSI has been providing mental health services in Blackhawk County for more than 25 years. The programs provide wraparound care for children as well as their families who are struggling with a serious behavioral or emotional diagnosis. Now turn to the next page and see what we've got here. Tell you what, we are approaching the half hour part of our program, of our broadcast here today. So why don't I remind you that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and we're reading the e-edition of the Courier here for today on Tuesday, the 28th of November. We are just a few days out to the beginning of December. Christmas is coming fast, folks. Really fast. All right. Tell you what. Let's do some obituary news, and then we'll get back to reading the news of the Courier here. Betty Ann Young has passed. Visitation will be on Sunday, November 26th from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly, and for an hour prior to services on Monday. Service will be Monday, November 27th. At 11 a.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church, Maxfield, rural Denver, followed by burial in the church cemetery. And you can also send online condolences at www.kaiser, that's K-A-I-S-E-R, Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, all one word, .com. We've got Roger Allen, at the age of 79, has passed. At the Triple E nursing home. And let's see if we can find the funeral services. Here we go. Will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, November 29th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church, Klinger, with Reverend Miguel Feliciano officiating. Burial will follow in the church cemetery. If you need more information about that, you can call the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home at 319-279-3551. And let's see what else we have. We've got James Gamerdinger has passed at the age of 91 at his home, surrounded by family. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, November 26th at Morris Funeral Home in Gutenberg, where a vigil service will commence at 6 p.m. Visitation will continue from 9 to 10 o'clock a.m. on Monday. And there, the church is located at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Gutenberg, Iowa. And that, again, is on Monday, the 27th of November. James M. Marty McConville, age 71, of Waterloo, has passed at Mercy One Waterloo. And let's see if we can find funeral services. Yes, here we are. Services will be held at 10:30 on Saturday, the 2nd of December, at the Central Christian Church in Waterloo. And visitation will be on Friday, the 1st of December, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Lock Tower Park. And they're located at 4140 Kimball Avenue. And a little flowers, memorials may be directed to the Central Christian Church on the Iowa Irish Fest. And finally, Shirley Capel has passed at the age of 85 at Prairie Hills in Independence. She, let's see if we have any funeral services. Yes, here we go. Services will be at 12 o'clock p.m. on Friday, the 1st of December, at the First Congregational Church of Christ in Waterloo, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Memorials may be directed to the church. All right, let's move on here now to the next section of our paper here. We're working our way through here. Now we're in the Cedar Valley, Iowa area of the paper. Renaissance man, cinematographer will watch Beyoncé film in Cedar Valley premiere. Award-winning cinematographer and Cedar Falls native Ben Haggerty will be in the audience on Thursday when Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, premieres in movie theaters across the U.S. I'll be in Waterloo Crossroads Cinema to watch the 7 p.m. movie with friends and family, and then another gathering Cedar Falls, Marcus College Square Cinema, with a late show because that's the theater where I grew up watching movies, he says. That's after having attended a secret premiere in L.A. earlier in the week, along with Beyoncé and Jay-Z Lotz of their Celebrating Friendship and the film and the World Tour crew. Haggerty was a cinematographer for Renaissance. It's fun to share this part of my life with my family and friends, and I'm curious to see how people I really care about will react. My sister and I were watching the movie trailer, and I'm going, I shot that, and I shot that, and I shot that, and that, and that. My mom is saying, is that you shooting that? There's so much happening that's hard to digest, Haggerty says. Beyoncé's mega world tour started in Europe, and Haggerty spent several months there filming rehearsals and later on tour in Europe and U.S. capturing performances and behind-the-scenes footage. It's chaos, it's nuts, and it is awesome all at the same time. But it's cool to see the amount of chaos, 600 people involved. It was the biggest stage on the planet. Beyoncé and Taylor Swift were the top two touring artists. So much work goes into a project like this. It's cool when the pieces all come together. While the lion's share of footage Haggerty captured was edited by the film editors, I do some editing on the road trying to identify our best moments. Renaissance is Haggerty's second Beyoncé project. He filmed on the 2019 Grammy Award-winning Homecoming about the singer's performance at the 2018 Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival, which Beyoncé wrote and directed. He's also filmed projects with Jay-Z, Chris Brown, Alicia Keys, Mary J. Blige, Schoolboy Q, among many other artists and brand name companies, including Disney, Adidas, and the NFL. The filmmaker is an official Canon camera ambassador, creating contents and commercials for the iconic brand. I'm so proud to be able to work alongside Beyoncé and try to match her energy and her efforts. It makes me a better filmmaker and creative to learn one of the best in the game. I'm always pumped to work with Beyoncé and Jay-Z, Haggerty says. As a kid growing up in Cedar Falls, Haggerty commandeered his parents' video camera to create short videos. He then got music and began filming music videos. He also earned a communications degree from the University of Northern Iowa. He dreamt about enrolling in film school and hunkering down in the mountains of Colorado, making snowboarding movies. He never made it. Instead, Haggerty moved to Los Angeles in 2015, sleeping on an air mattress on a friend's floor, paying his dues for more than a year. He also networked like a madman, parlaying one connection to the next in the filming and music industries. His first major break was working on the documentary project Chris Brown, Welcome to My Life, as an assistant and co-editor. Haggerty started his own brand, Black with No Cream, in 2017. I'm really keen on giving back and providing education and access and networking to other creatives. It's been special to have it run parallel to my career. He's now creating a production company. After 8 years in L.A., Haggerty returned to Cedar Falls about a year ago to be near his family while his dad, Pat battles cancer. All right, let's take a look here. Iowa casino and sports betting revenue drops. Drop in sports betting is first since legalized. In Des Moines, gamblers bet more than $4 billion at Iowa-licensed casinos and sports books in fiscal 2023, and even after that average of nearly $11 million a day in wagers represented a decline for both in-person casino and online sports betting, Iowa sports betting revenue dropped in the fiscal year that ended in June for the first time since the Iowa legislature legalized it in 2019. And it was a significant drop. There was $2.247 billion in sports bets made in the 2023 state budget year, down from $2.455 billion in the same period and the previous year, an 8.5% decline, according to state figures. And for just the second time in the past decade, but excluding the worst pandemic year, casino gambling revenue in Iowa also dropped from the previous year. According to figures from the Iowa Racing and Gaming Association, which oversees the gambling industry in the state, gambling revenue at the 19 state-licensed casinos was more than $1.754 billion in fiscal 2023. That's down slightly, 0.7%, from the $1.766 billion recorded in the previous budget year. Admissions to Iowa's casinos already had been declining, and there were 17.1 million admissions to the licensed casinos in 2022, down from 17.8 million in 2021, according to a state report. That continued a trend of declining attendance that started before the pandemic struck in 2020. Beginning in 2013, casino gambling revenues in Iowa have increased annually, with only two other exceptions. In 2019, when it dropped slightly, just 0.5% from $1.463 billion to $1.457 billion, and in 2020, when the industry took a huge hit from the COVID-19 pandemic. Wes Elrike, a president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Gaming Association, which represents the 19 licensed casinos, said that the mild dip in fiscal 2023 revenue may be due in part to a right sizing of the industry after two consecutive years of spikes after the worst of the pandemic. Coming out of the worst of the pandemic, the $1.457 billion recorded in fiscal 2019 surged to $1.57 billion in fiscal 2021 and $1.766 billion in fiscal 2022. When we came out of the COVID, we had kind of a bump at that time. There was a lot of pent-up demand. People were getting back and stuff like that, and people providing other things. I think that revenue drop in the most recent year was really most about coming off COVID, having the bump, the pent-up demand, and then it came back maybe to more of a normal year. Today, it's going to be a blend of sun and clouds, and it's going to be chilly, a high of 31 degrees. And then tonight, it will be mostly clear, a low of 22 degrees. And then on Wednesday, it'll be sunny and not as cold, a high of 44, a low of 25. On Thursday, it will be mostly sunny, a high of 42, a low of 20 degrees. On Friday, sun and some clouds, a high of 37, a low of 23. And the outlook for Saturday, a p.m. shower, ice at night, a high of 46 and a low of 30 degrees. In the National Forecast Outlook, shifting bands of lake effect snow will continue for locations. Downwind of the Great Lakes today with snow squalls extending over the interior northeast. High pressures will continue to bring dry weather, cool air, and a mostly sunny sky to the west, the plains, and much of the south. At the same time, the northwest will begin to turn warmer as we're going into this El Nino weather pattern that we have. Okay, now let's move on here to the next section of our paper. We're now going to go to 360 degrees, which is covering the world and national news here in our paper. Let's take a look and see what we've got here. Raising Better Beef. This is an environment and diet section of the paper. Rancher tries to make cattle easier on planet. In Roston, Texas, the cattle part as Meredith Ellis edges her small four-wheeler through the herd, silently counting the cows and the calves. It's the way she starts most days on her 3,000-acre Texas ranch, ensuring all the cattle are safe, deciding when they should move to another pasture, and ensuring the grass is as healthy as her animals. We're looking for the sweet spot, where the land and the cattle help each other, Ellis says, as she rumbles down a dirt road to check on another herd. You want to find that balance. Much of Ellis's work evolved from the ranching her father practiced for decades. Her parents built this ranch, and it's where Ellis was raised. Now it's her turn to make the decisions. She's implemented changes her father couldn't dream of, because for her and other ranchers, their livelihoods and the future of the planet are on the line. For generations, beef has been a way of life in Texas. And the most quintessential of American main courses and a premium protein around the world. It's also the single most damaging food for the planet. Beef is the largest agricultural source of greenhouse gases worldwide. It has a bigger carbon footprint than any other type of protein. Climate scientists say that the answer is simple. Eat less beef and raise fewer cattle. But most people around the world are consuming more beef, not less. Ellis finds herself at ground zero. Texas has by far the most cattle in the U.S., which is the biggest producer of beef in the world. And it's here that Ellis believes she can make a difference. I don't want to do this if it isn't good for the environment, Ellis said. I want ranching to be part of the climate solution. For Ellis, that solution lies in the practice of regenerative ranching. In theory, it's a holistic way to look at the earth, animals, and water, and how they'll all interact. In practice, it's an exhausting, never-ending process of moving her cattle to different pastures in an effort to restore the soil. What I'm looking to do is make a major impact and completely redefine the beef industry, Ellis says. I want to take everyone with me. Ellis took over the ranch north of Dallas in 2013. She's faced all the critical questions surrounding the beef industry, but no issue has been more important than beef's contribution to climate change. Cattle belch out serious amounts of greenhouse gases, especially methane. About 220 pounds a year of methane, which is 80 times more harmful than carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas spewed out by cars. Overall, beef production creates enough carbon that cutting herd sizes by even 10% to 20% could make a difference, experts say. They agree that reducing consumption, particularly in America, is a clearer place to start. Americans eat the equivalent of about 3 hamburgers a week. Research shows that if they cut that in half and instead export U.S. beef to other countries, the world will have a greater chance of meeting demand without cutting forests and expanding cattle grazing lands. For Ellis, regenerative ranching is not only the most efficient, but the most environmentally responsible route. The theory harkens back to the 30 million bison that once thundered through the plain states. Herds would essentially annihilate grasslands by eating the vegetation and pummeling the ground. The ground looked trash, but their hoofs stimulated the soil. The animals coated the ground with nitrogen-rich waste, and then the animals left for months or even years, allowing the grasses to grow. Regenerative ranchers try to do roughly the same by moving cattle frequently. They're kept in spaces where they can trample grass and soil and then move on. The goal is to produce more grass that will generate deep roots to take carbon from the air and permanently store it underground. For Ellis, regenerative ranching means moving her family's herd of 320 cows, calves, and heifers, plus several bulls through 58 fenced pastures. In daily checks, Ellis and her ranch manager examine not only the animals, but the grass. It's a state of symbiosis to where the cattle benefit from the land and the land benefits from the cattle, she says. In most ranches, that's still how it's done. Thousands of ranchers are incorporating regenerative practices, but only a small percentage have completely transformed their operations. Ellis has opened her ranch to researchers from the nonprofit Ecosystem Services Market Consortium for readings from hundreds of sites. And so far, their study shows that Ellis's work is making a difference. Each year, the ranch is sequestering about 2,500 tons of atmospheric carbon dioxide, and that is equivalent to the annual emissions from about 500 cars. That number has inched up as Ellis makes more changes. Ellis sees global warming altering her land. She calls it an existential crisis, the backdrop to the endless to-do list. After a long day, she likes to take a moment to remember why she does this. She watches over a gate as dozens of cows graze amid the lush grass and a setting sun and says, "I could stand here all evening." Ellis knows she could make more money selling in a niche market. She could sell her land for development. But Ellis has other plans. She's taking a leadership role in a group that wants to see industry-wide change with animal welfare and land sustainability practices eventually leading to higher prices for ranchers who adopt. "That is the most important thing I could possibly do with my life," Ellis says. "At the end of the day, no amount of money or anything could persuade me to do otherwise." All right, what else do we have going on here? There's been quite a lot of news lately about sea turtles. Now, this particular article is about how there has been a surge of sea turtles. There's a picture here of a pair of green sea turtle hatchlings that are making their way to the Atlantic Ocean at the Canaveral seashore in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Let's take a look at this article. Let's see what it has to say. Indian Rocks Beach in Florida, just as they have for millions of years, sea turtles by the thousands make their labored crawl from the ocean to the U.S. beaches to lay their eggs over the past several months. This year, record nestings was found in Florida and elsewhere, despite growing concern about threats from climate change. In Florida, preliminary state statistics show that than 133,840 loggerhead turtle nests, breaking a record set in 2016. Same for the green turtles, where the estimate of at least 76,500 nests is well above the previous mark set in 2017. High sea turtle nest numbers also have been reported in South Carolina, Alabama, North Carolina, and Georgia, although not all set records like Florida, where Justin Perrault, VP of Research at Loggerhead Marine Life Center in Juneau Beach, said that the number of nests is remarkable this year. We had more nests than we had ever seen before on our local beaches, he says. That's quite a bit of nesting. Palm Beach County broke a local record by 4,000 nests. There are 7 species of sea turtles: loggerhead, green, leatherback, hawksbill, Kemp's Ridley, olive Ridley, and flatback. All we considered either all are considered either endangered or threatened. They come ashore on summer nights, digging pits in the sand, depositing dozens of eggs before covering them up and returning to the sea. Florida beaches are one of the most important hatcheries for loggerheads in the world. Only about 1,000 sea turtle hatchlings live to adulthood. They face myriad natural threats, including predators on land and in the ocean, disruptions to nests, and failure to make it to the water after hatching. This year, along one stretch of the Florida Gulf Coast where 75 nests have been counted, most were wiped out by the surge from Hurricane Ida in August. We've got just a few minutes left. I'm going to read some of this article, Artificial Intelligence Reforms. Tech industry pushes back against pleas for copyright protections. Country singers, romance novelists, video game artists, voice actors are appealing to the U.S. government for relief as soon as possible from the threat that artificial intelligence poses to their livelihoods. Please regulate artificial intelligence. I'm scared, wrote a podcaster concerned about his voice becoming replicated by AI in one of the thousands of letters recently submitted to the U.S. Copyright Office. Technology companies, by contrast, are largely happy with the status quo that has enabled them to gobble up published works to make their AI systems better at mimicking what humans do. The nation's top copyright official hasn't yet taken sides, and she's listening to everyone at her office weighs whether copyright reforms are needed for a new era of generative AI tools that can spit out compelling imagery, music, video, and passages of text. We've received close to 10,000 comments, said Shura Perlmutter, the U.S. Register of Copyrights. Every one of them is being read by a human being, not a computer. And I myself am reading a large part of them. And then the article, like I say, goes on for quite a while, but I did want to read a little bit of that for you because that is a danger for the show business world. And I want to say thank you for listening here. That just about does it here for the reading of our e-edition of The Courier here for Tuesday, November 28th. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you have been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Thank you so much for listening today. Take care. Bye-bye now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.